Dragnet.
The Jack Benny Program.
I'm that man. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal.
George Burns and Gracie Allen.
Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum.
We offer you Escape.
Our Miss Brooks.
Suspense.
Richard Diamond, Private Detective.
Fibber McGee and Molly.
The Great Gildersleeve.
Yeah. Radio Theater.
In the air.
Dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind.
You know what our call letters WGN stand for, don't you?
WGN Radio Theater.
The special three-hour presentation
with Carl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
All right, about 8 minutes after 11 p.m. here on the WGN Radio Theater. I'm your host, Carl Amari. This is program 324 in the series. It's October 6th. It's a Saturday night. And we're here to play classic radio shows for you. To my right, the vivacious Lisa Wolf, the dimply Lisa. What's up, dimply?
Hey, Carl, what's up?
What's going on?
Everything's good.
How
what's
are
going
you?
On? I'm good. I went apple picking today, so it was a big day.
Really? That's better than the regular picking that you do.
Yes.
Hang on a second.
Got it.
We have Shantae Garth in the booth. She is our producer, as always. And we're going to listen to Hall of Fantasy, a good mystery, because you know what, Lisa? We're in October now.
Because you are a mystery.
Yeah.
And that too.
You know, my favorite, I would say my second favorite holiday is Halloween.
And the first?
Christmas. I love Christmas. I love playing the Christmas shows.
Oh, yeah.
But I love Halloween because I love scary shows.
I'm pretty big on Halloween, too.
Yeah, we have the Hall of Fantasy, although the show we were originally scheduled to play, Death in the Bayous, is going to be replaced by The Mark of Shame because Mike said the quality, there was a couple little issues in it. So we switched it out for a better quality show. And that's coming your way in just a few minutes. Then Nick Carter, Master Detective from 1948. And then a show that is new to our library of programs. You know, we're always finding new shows. This is called Somebody Knows. And it was a true-to-life series where they would take murder mysteries that were unsolved. So just like unsolved mysteries, okay?
Right, sure.
And they would dramatize this murder, and they would hope people out there listening would know who did this. And they called the show Somebody Knows. In other words, somebody knows who did this.
Yeah, I understand. I get it. But thank you.
Well, you know, there was a very celebrated murder case back in the 1940s called The Black Dahlia. In fact, they made a movie about it. Mike Starr is in that movie. And there was this very beautiful woman who came to Hollywood. She wanted to be a movie star. Her name was Elizabeth Short. And they found her murdered and kind of gruesomely murdered. And they never found her murderer. And that's the show.
Are you talking about The Black Dahlia?
Yeah, The Black Dahlia. Yes. That's right, The Black Dahlia. We are going to broadcast a show called The Elizabeth Short Murder Case on Somebody Knows. But yes, then later it became known as The Black Dahlia Case, and there was a movie about it. I'm sure you know about that, David.
I do vaguely remember a movie about it,
yeah,
yes. Wasn't there more than one?
There might have been, but there was a pretty big movie, and I'm trying to think who was in
theatrical,
it.
Theatrical, and I think there may have been also a TV version.
It could have been. Yeah, it could have been.
Because that was, at the time, it was... was a huge deal in L.A. because they'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah,
it was
very
grisly.
Brutal, very brutal murder. And that's show three tonight here on the WGN Radio Theater. So don't touch that dial. But we're going to start things off with a new little kind of
segment.
Yeah, segment.
We've retired Crack the Quote. Because
we have, because I was going broke paying
because
10 cents.
Because we get bored and we like to change things up.
Yeah, we do.
We.
Okay.
And so we have a new segment. It's called Cat's Pride's Oldies But Goodies. And we will be playing songs that are from the same time period as the show that we will be about to be playing, but actually from the same a hit from that month and that year,
okay,
of the radio show.
Right.
So the first song will be a big hit from March of 1948.
All right.
Do you want the name of it?
Well, no. Let's play our little opening.
All right.
All right, Shantae. Well, Well, that wasn't exactly what we had hoped to play. We wanted the very beginning of the song all the way to that point, but that's okay. So let's, what is the song?
The song, what, the song that we're going to play for Cats?
Yeah, this is going well.
Okay. The song is called Managua, Nicaragua by Freddie Martin and his orchestra. It was a big hit in March of 1948.
Okay, let's play it.
Out of sorts, I'd like to recommend a look
in Managua, Nicaragua. What a wonderful spot! There's coffee and bananas and the temperature hot. So take a trip and on a ship go sailing away across the aqua to Managua, Nicaragua. Ole. There's coffee and bananas and the temperature hot. So take a trip and on a ship go sailing away across the aqua to Managua, Nicaragua.
Man, songs have changed, have they not?
Well, that's what I was going to say. This just gives another layer of what was going on and what was appreciated during March of 1948. This was called Managua, Nicaragua by Freddie Martin and his orchestra.
Man.
And I think it puts us in the mood for our radio show, Hall of Fantasy.
I guess it does.
Put me in the mood.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go to a commercial break. We come back, and we're going to listen to the Hall of Fantasy. Stick around. Text us if you have any questions or any comments about the show. We love getting your texts. 312-981-7200. We'll be here till 2 o'clock in the morning tonight playing all your favorite classic radio shows. It's time for the Hall of Fantasy. Good mystery. Richard Thorne created this show back in 1946. It was a mystery horror series. And he not only starred in these, he directed them, wrote some of them. And the cast members were Chicago's best. Carl Grayson, fellow Carl.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
Jim Amici, which was Don Amici's brother, Harry Elders, and Richard Thorne. They all starred in this. And then in 1952, it moved to Mutual. It was sponsored by the Granite Furniture Company. But right now we have a 1947 broadcast from May 4th of that year. Richard Thorne starring in The Mark of Shame. Here's part one of the Hall of Fantasy.
Sugar House, Murray and Provo presents The Hall of Fantasy. Fantasy.
Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall descend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Mark of Shame.
The Granite Furniture Company brings you the Hall of Fantasy. Listen now to original tales of the imagination and some of the classics of the supernatural as we take you down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to the mysterious realms of the unknown. These are stories of eerie and fantastic thrills brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Stores. And now for tonight's story, an adaptation by Robert Olson entitled The Mark of Shame.
The blood that coursed through the veins of Cousin Andre did more than run the natural errands of existence. That blood fed his hates, his prides, his willful ego, to the end of time and beyond. Yes, and that same blood flushed a vivid red mark of shame in Andre's fair young face. It was phenomenal. Nothing like I'd ever seen before. Nothing, certainly, like the welts on a child's tender back. This mark never faded from his handsome, womanish cheek. As usual, it had started over a woman. This happened at a masquerade ball given in the Palais Royal. A logical setting for quarrels over women, or privileges, or just quarrels. It was a gay affair. The women who followed in the footsteps of Philip of Orléans were likely grounds for controversy. One could hardly refer to their love as steadfast, but their favors swung from one brightly caped courtier to the other, from a fallen sword to a victorious one, with the swiftness of death itself. But such were our times. And in this colorful gathering, it was not difficult to recognize the predominant shade as a blood red. No need to mention the woman's name. Makes no difference anyway. She was not the issue. The issue was that André de Brissac, darling of the court, had been shamed, and I had dealt the smarting blow. I remember that moment with amazing detail. It was as if everything in that ballroom had suddenly been caught in startling paralysis of time, poised between one tick of the clock and another, one heartbeat and the next. Even the note of the music hung suspended, undecided whether to fly out the rich windows or fall in splendor like a Christmas ornament. I remember the dancers caught midway in a step, their faces turned toward me, the frozen gasp of the woman in question, sound that seemed barely to clear her lips, and paused in the awful highlight of that instant. And in Andre's eyes, poised the sharp, tempered steel of hatred and humiliation. Then, as if some unseen conductor waved the baton, the room was once more animated. The clock completed its tick, the heart its beat, and the note its soaring flight. The hatred of Andre de Brissac flushed from the eye to the heart to the brain, thence to the voice that made it live in my memory forever. But the most amazing phenomena occurred a moment later, while he still stared at me. For to André, there came a crimson blush of shame, clearly outlined by the very form of my hand, in the exact spot where it had landed a flashing, stinging slap. So it was that on that dim August dawn, André and I crossed to one of the bridges that led to the ground beyond the church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés to fight a duel over a beautiful viper of the court of Philip of Orléans. André stood there opposite me with his two young friends at his side. They were all scoundrels, including my cousin, sorry to say. They seemed eager for this sport. We must have made a strange sight in that golden sunrise hour. We had just come from the Regent Saloon, still in the costumes we'd worn the night before. I was adorned, if adorn is the proper word for it, as a Mississippi Indian, while André wore a unique hunting habit, copied from a portrait that hung in the library of Puy Verdun, the family chateau. The orange and purple of his adornment looked pale in this early light. The mark on his face was all the more vivid.
I am ready, cousin.
André, when this is over, no matter what happens, will you promise me one thing?
Please. When this is over, one of us will be standing, the other dead. That's the only promise I care to make now.
That's true, André. But you force me into a situation for which I have no appetite. I'm a soldier, André. It is my business to cut down my enemy.
Now, I'm the better swordsman. That's why we must talk now or not at all.
Then if you don't mind, cousin, we'll make it not at all. As for your being a better swordsman, you'll do me the honor of proving your skill.
Your curly locks have sabotaged your good judgment, sir. The captivating ladies of the court shall miss their nimble-tongued darling.
Ah, but they shan't miss his boorish cousin. Enough of this. On guard!
On guard, cousin! You stand well, my merry fellow of fortune. But I could teach you much.
Conserve your breath, cousin!
Ah, your beautiful face, André. Your parry was poor. I saw it tipped with crimson. Your lovely powder bear would swoon to see that. It goes ill for you, I fear.
You glowed over a scratch.
André was really quite skillful, but not skillful enough. My contention that the court's fencing master could never compare to the art of learn or die brutality of battle proved correct. I mortally wounded André, and instantly I was mortally sorry. Life had been sweet for him as he lay there on the ground, the golden morning sun giving his beautiful features a pitiful glow. I thought I saw a look of despair come into his eyes. He realized that his lifeblood was ebbing away like a tide that would never return. He beckoned to me, and I walked over to him and knelt at his side. André, forgive me.
Listen to me, Hector de Brazac. This is not the end of us. I am not done with the earth. Just because my jaw will soon stiffen and my eyes glaze over, they will bury me in the old vault at Puebla Dan. But that is not the end either. You will be the master of the chateau. They may even laugh to think that André has been killed in a duel. They will sing masses to my soul, and I will be done with them all. You have accomplished that, Hector, but you and I have not finished our business. I will be with you when you least know me. André de Brazac, with an ugly scar on a face that women have praised and loved. I'll come back when your life is its merriest. At your happiest moment, I will come between you and all that you hold dear. And when this hand is a ghostly thing, dear cousin, I shall drop a poison potion into your cup of happiness. I shall stand between you and the sun for the rest of your life. Doubt not my will, Hector de Brazac. I can do as I please. And it pleases me to haunt you when I am dead.
I did not doubt the iron will of André. As he lay his head back on the dewy earth, never to lift it again, the chill breath of early morning touched me with inexpressible loneliness. I looked at him as he lay in his fresh, wan world of sleep. How fragile he seemed, built only for lace cuffs and bright buckles. I could see why he had been such a favorite. I could almost, even now, catch the fiery twinkle of those clear eyes. And no one who knew the short manhood of my cousin could deny the great force of his tempestuous nature. No, I looked down upon that young face which I had marked so foully, was sorry for what I had done, truly sorry. As for the curse, I took no heed of the blasphemous threats. I was a soldier. I had seen many men die for my own sword. André had done me a cruel wrong. I couldn't have forgiven it. Men had died cursing me before. Men who had loved life as rapturously as André. One more curse was... Well, one more curse. I put it out of my mind. A very foolish thing to do. André's death had made me rich. But I found no pleasure in the wealth. This chateau, which had rung so with the raucous laughter of André's friend, became quiet and lonely. None of the servants showed me the slightest sign of friendliness. Even in the village, the children would shrink from me as I rode through. That's why I was so happy when the servant announced that Monsieur le Directeur was waiting to see me. Dr. Corday, I'm delighted, monsieur.
Oh, thank you, my lord. I have some medical reports on the patients in the village. I thought you might want to look them over.
I know nothing about such things, Corday. If there's no ravaging epidemic, I should be happy to dispense with it altogether.
Ah, there's nothing to fear. The usual aches and our share of deaths and our share of babies.
Good, doctor. Will you join me?
Well, I...
Do, monsieur.
Thank you.
Dr. Corday, What do the people in the village say about me?
Say? Why, the people love you, my lord.
You can dispense with them, my lord, Corday. I'm a soldier, not a court dandy. What do the people really say?
Shall I tell you?
Of course you should tell me. Why do you suppose I asked you? Oh, monsieur, forgive me. This is a bitter life. I have no taste for it. I'd rather be a soldier. I really would.
Well, in that case, you'd be quite interested in hearing what the people of the village say.
What is that?
That you have sold your soul to the evil one for your cousin's heritage.
That's really funny, Doctor. Really very funny. I never wanted this life, never once. I wouldn't hesitate a moment to trade it for a place in His Majesty's troops.
What you need is a wife, my lord.
A wife? I can't even win the sympathetic ear of a friend, let alone the heart of a lady.
It's a very gay season in Paris right now, my lord. You should find an angel there to take compassion on you.
Paris? A marvelous idea. At least I can be my own man there. Doctor, I'm grateful for your visit. Come in again when I return.
With a wife?
Who knows?
All right, that's the first portion of The Hall of Fantasy with The Mark of Shame from 1947. More after these words.
Back to WGN Radio Theater with Earl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
So, Lisa.
Yes, Carl?
Are you scared with this Hall of Fantasy radio show? It's pretty scary.
I generally get scared just sitting here next to you each weekend because you just never know what's going to fall out of your mouth.
Halloween is right around the corner.
Yeah, you know, I went to the House of Torment on Friday night with my daughter.
That's scary stuff.
It was a WGN radio event, and I think that I showed up, and I think David Miranda, who is one of the reporters here, also showed up
a little bit
later.
Morton Grove or somewhere?
It's in Morton Grove, yeah, and it was...
Scary.
It was a fun, scary night.
Well, we'll have a lot of scary radio shows from now through Halloween for you, Saturday and Sunday nights, and we're here every Saturday and Sunday, beginning at 11 p.m. On Saturdays, we're here till 2 a.m., and on Sundays, we're here till 1 a.m. Our text line, 312-981-7200. We're listening to The Hall of Fantasy. Here's the conclusion.
In Paris, I ran into an old comrade, a sulky, sour old captain of dragoons. Many times he'd aired his displeasures to me. He told me a great many things about himself. But one thing he should have talked about, he never even mentioned. That was that he had a perfect sunbeam for a daughter. That her name was... Can you hear the music as I say it? Eveline. Eveline Lecollet. Eveline, I've been a fool.
Is it wise to tell me, monsieur?
Wise or not, I must. Eveline, I've been a soldier all my life. I know little about what pleases a lady. When I take your hand, I'm filled with the fear that you will not feel as I do, that there's someone else.
There is no one, monsieur.
Thank heaven. Eveline, I've wasted the best years of my youth worshipping a wicked woman who cheated me and finally made a fool of me.
She was the fool, monsieur.
Bless you for saying that, Eveline. Well, you must know what I'm trying to say. I'm told women do know. I love you, Eveline. I want you to go back to Puy-Verdun with me.
Oh, monsieur.
As my wife, will you?
You will have to speak to my father.
Forgive me, but I already have.
Oh, you are a soldier, monsieur.
But what is your answer, Eveline?
I will marry you.
Oh, Eveline, my adorable one. This is...
Yes, go on. Is anything the matter?
No. No, of course not. This is the happiest moment of my life.
You are listening to The Mark of Shame on tonight's journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy. Brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Company with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo. And now, back to tonight's story, The Mark of Shame. Puy-Verdun was not the sordid, lonely place I had left. The difference was my charming bride. Now, when I rode through the village, the children actually crowded about our carriage. I no longer feared the de Bussac who sat beside the lady. Her charities had won her their love and transformed the gloomy lord into a gentle master. They even forgot the untimely death of my cousin. And I no longer hesitated with that strange catch in my throat to tell her about it. Eveline, I never knew I could be so happy.
Why, too, Hector. I'm happier than I ever dreamed.
Even the villagers feel it. They used to avoid me like a plague.
You only imagine that. Why should they avoid such a gentle master?
Maybe it's because you've made me so, Evelyn. I feel like a traveler who's just been transplanted from the frozen Arctic wastes to the heart of some green and friendly valley. It's almost... Oh, I don't know, darling. Sometimes I doubt it.
Why, dearest?
It seems almost fantastic to be so happy. I could be aroused so rudely at any moment with a coarse shout of reality.
You aren't dreaming, husband. I won't allow it. For you know, if you were, I would be too, and I wouldn't like that.
See what I mean? Nothing like this ever happened to me before. It's like standing in the bright sun.
Hector?
Yes?
Who's the lord of the chateau nearest to this?
What?
Who is he, Hector?
Darling, don't you realize that this is the only chateau within 40 miles?
That's strange.
Why?
Because I saw him again yesterday.
Him? Whom did you see?
I don't know now.
Suppose you tell me about it.
Well, in my walks about the park and woods in the past month, I keep meeting a man who appears to be of a noble rank.
Of noble rank? Are you sure you don't mean a peasant?
No. His dress and his bearing was that of a nobleman. I couldn't have mistaken that. I imagined that he must occupy some chateau near Puy Verdun.
That's not possible, Evelyn. We're in the heart of a desolate region. No, that couldn't be possible. Well, come here a moment.
Yes, monsieur?
See the picture there on the wall?
This one, monsieur?
No, the one next to it. That's right. I want you to...
Yes, monsieur?
I want a curtain hung over that picture as soon as possible, understand?
Oui, monsieur.
Good. Now bring some tea to your lady's drawing room. In spite of myself, I was disturbed by Evelyn's visitant. That night I asked her more about it. Evelyn, this man you say you saw...
Say I saw. I did, in fact, I do see him.
How often?
Every day.
Every day where?
Sometimes in the park and sometimes in the wood. You know that little cascade and the old rock work that makes a sort of a cavern?
Yes, I know the place. I used to play there as a boy.
Oh, I love it. I spend my mornings there reading.
And that's where you saw... see him?
Yes.
Has he ever had the courage to address you?
Never. I look up from my book and he'll be standing there very quietly, watching me. Then I'll continue with my reading, and when I look up again, he's gone.
He must be some peasant out to frighten you. I'll go into the village tomorrow and see what I can find out.
No, Hector, he's not a peasant. He has the manner of a nobleman.
I suppose he's quite old.
On the contrary, he's young and quite handsome.
For the next week, I spent my mornings with Evelyn. We took many casual rambles into the woods and park, but we saw no one but a few peasants or occasionally a member of our own chateau. These works were beginning to disturb the routine of my life. And since I was a man of rather deeply ingrained habits, my wife noticed the unrest.
There's no need to take these walks with me, Hector. You know, you have other things to do. I'll spend my mornings on the grounds, and the stranger can't intrude on me there.
I'm beginning to think the stranger is your own fantasy, darling. You've probably met too many handsome cavaliers in your books. No doubt he's some Persian prince in modern costume.
Hector, that's what puzzled me. The stranger's costume isn't modern. Shall I tell you what it looks like?
By all means.
Well, he looks as if he's been in an old portrait that had stepped down from his frame.
It wouldn't have been a more startling blow if she'd butted me in the stomach with the end of a staff. I thought of the picture in the library with the orange and purple hunting costume André had worn that fateful night in the Palais Royal. But then something else happened to take my mind from the picture, André or anything else. For after a time, my wife, who had always been as lovely and glowing as the fresh petal of a rose, began to fail in her health. A change seemed to have stolen up on her. Even I, who had seen her every day, hadn't noticed it until one day she put on a lovely gown she hadn't worn in several months. I was amazed how loosely it hung on her. Then I noticed her eyes. Eyes that had at one time sparkled as bright as the jewel she'd planted in her hair. They were now quite dim and sick. Darling, how long have you been ill?
I'm not ill, Hector.
That's insane. You are ill. Quite seriously so, I might add. Stupid of me not to notice it before. What's done this?
I feel faint.
And she fainted. I caught her in my arms and swept her to her bed. Then I sent a messenger for Dr. Corday. Tell him to come immediately. I don't want a single moment's delay, understand?
Yes, monsieur.
I stood there as helpless as a child and watched my lovely Evelyn seem to waste away with this insidious thing. I cursed every moment of delay before Dr. Corday arrived. When he did come, I rushed him to a room before he even had a chance to remove his cape. Then I sat and poured myself a drink for the torturous wait. But even before he came out to speak to me, I, for no explainable reason, had lost faith in the powers of medicine to combat the thing that had struck down my Evelyn.
Strange, very strange.
Doctor, is she...
Frankly, I don't know. I just don't know, my lord.
Monsieur le docteur, I was beginning to be afraid that she may be a little... Well, Dr. Corday, this isn't easy to say.
Well, then, let me say it for you. You're wondering if she's insane. Let me assure you that she is not.
Oh, thank heaven. She's been seeing some... Well...
Oh, you mean this strange visitant? Oh, yes, she spoke of it. It's possible that she may be suffering from some sort of illusion at that. But she's so rational on all the other accounts. I think that this person is quite real, at least to the eye. Usually a monomaniac tells very incoherent stories of their illusions. Hers is no such thing. She speaks as calmly and rationally as you and I. Are you positive that there is no one who can encounter her in her walks about the garden?
Well, I don't see how. The moat is 10 feet wide and continually flooded with water. Raoul keeps the lock secured day and night. No, I don't see how it's possible.
Well, perhaps someone related to your household in some way. A young man with a fair womanish face and a crimson scar that looks as if it might have been the mark of a violent blow.
Oh, no. The dress, Doctor. How's he dressed?
In a hunting costume. A purple and orange hunting costume.
Doctor, this... Oh, no. What can I do?
Right now, my lord, you'd better go in and see Lady de Brissac. She's asked for you.
Darling, how are you?
Oh, Hector.
Evelyn, why haven't you told me? The doctor says you've seen the stranger again.
I see him every day. That's what's killing me.
I rushed down the library, took down the portrait, and showed it to my wife. She looked at it and trembled like a leaf. She clung to me as if she were about to fall into some nameless chasm.
It's witchcraft. The costume is the very same.
Then she described his face to me, line for line, even to the cruel mark my hand had left. I knew that Henri de Brissac had come back to keep his promise. I took Evelyn away. We traveled through the southern provinces and on into the heart of Switzerland. I wanted to outdistance the phantom. It was no good. He followed us everywhere we went. Never did I see him. Always Evelyn. That type of vengeance had Andre's touch. He used my wife's innocent heart as his cruel weapon. His constant, unholy intrusion was destroying her. Nor could I shield her or drive Andre from her.
He's here even now, Hector. As you stand there and I here, he stands between us. He'll never let me rest nor let me forget him.
Thus it was I fought like a madman against something I couldn't see, fought through this terrible void to get back to the side of my beloved wife. And then, a short time later... We were in a Tyrolean village. It was a brilliant moonlit night. I was about to speak a word of encouragement to Evelyn when she spoke.
Hector, I'm going to tell you something so strange and terrible that you'll probably hate me forever.
Hate you? Why, my poor darling.
Oh, no, please, don't sympathize with me. I won't be able to tell you, and I must tell you, I must.
Darling, you're just tired. What you need is some
Hector,
rest.
Hector, I'm dying.
No. No, Evelyn, you're not.
Yes, I know it. That's why I must say what I have to say.
I won't listen.
You must listen. At first, when I began to see the stranger in the park, I shrank from him. He seemed terrible to me. Day after day, he came. Then one day, I wasn't afraid anymore. I found that I was thinking about him, watching for him. Then for a while, I didn't see him.
Was that when I was with you?
Yes. Even then, when I was with you, I found that I was desolate without him.
Evelyn, you don't know what you're saying.
Oh, believe me, Hector, I do. I wouldn't blame you if you killed me. But I began to count the hours to the time when I'd see him next. He took all the old joys from my heart and left me nothing but the unholy pleasure of his presence. Now, Hector, curse me, kill me, anything. Only know this. Whatever it was, witchcraft, the imperfections of my heart, I don't know. I only know I fought against it and couldn't win. Now I'm dying, and oh, forgive me if you can.
Forgive you? What is there to forgive, my darling? This is no work of yours. Oh, Evelyn, my wife, forget everything but that you're in my arms. Forget everything except that we love each other.
I'm dying, Hector. I'm dying.
No. Fight it, Evelyn. Please try to fight it. I need you. I can't live without you.
Forgive me, Hector. I want to die. I want to be with him.
Her eyes fluttered and she was gone. Something more than the cruel lash of her words hit me. Even though I was barely conscious, I felt it. I got up and ran to the mirror. Sure enough, there it was. That vivid outline of the hand, full across my cheek.
So runs the tale of The Mark of Shame. Remember to join us next week at the same time for another journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy.
Tonight's program was adapted from Miss Braddon's story, Evelyn's Visitant, by Robert Olson. Heard tonight were Richard Thorne as Hector, Beth Calder as Evelyn, Archie Hugely as Andre, Ken Jensen as Dr. Corday, and Michael Arogo as Raoul. Musical background was provided by Earl Donaldson. The engineer was Nephi Sorensen. These programs are produced and directed by Richard Thorne.
There you have it. That's the Hall of Fantasy, May 4th, 1947, with The Mark of Shame, starring Richard Thorne. We'll have more of the WGN Radio Theater after these words. Okay, you know, Lou Manfredini does those hair commercials. I see them on TV all the
hair
time.
Hair plugs?
Like their hair growth commercial? Or
they're not hair plugs.
What is it?
It's a different thing. I forgot
What's
the name of
called?
The company. He and Ryan Sandberg... Not Lou.
No. He does a different one than the one Ryan Sandberg does.
Okay. I know the doctor that Lou went. I know of the doctor that Lou went to.
Because I might need that pretty soon, Lisa.
Yeah, because you might be pulling your hair out to all the drama in your life.
No, I'm just saying. I might need that. I saw Lou on there. He looked good. You know, I got to find out which doctor he goes to for that. I'll talk to him when I see him next. I think he's out of town, though, because Dave Plyer is in for Lou Manfredini. And I love you know, he's Italian. I should be able to say his name right.
You should, but you have
Manfredini.
Sometimes you add a little extra N in there.
I like to throw an extra syllable.
Yeah,
in there.
It's not a syllable, just a letter.
But Lou looks good. His hair looks good.
Well, he always looks good.
I'm kind of thinking
he's a good-looking guy.
I think mine's kind of going back a little.
I think I know who the doctor is. I think I know because I've met him.
Yeah,
somewhere else, but I know who it is.
Yeah, well, he does a good job, and I'm gonna write his name down as soon as I can figure it out who the doctor is, because I think, Lisa, I might need a little of that down the road here.
Okay, well,
because I don't want to lose my hair.
Don't be pulling your hair out.
Some people can wear it, like Dave. He can wear it. He can wear the look.
What's the look? The chrome dome.
or depending on the hour of the day or how hot it is, the reflective chrome dome
look.
Well,
if you look great with it. If you had hair, it wouldn't look good. I like the way you look. And I just know you that way, right? I like you with that dome. My brother has the same thing. He looks good. I could never wear it. I just couldn't do it, Lisa.
Well, it's just in your own mind.
Yeah. I will sell no wine before it's time. So in the next hour, we're going to tune into Nick Carter, Master Detective, Lon Clark starring in that. I think our fun fact was about Lon Clark Carter, Master Detective, this week.
And it still
is. And then Somebody Knows, the Elizabeth Short murder case, also known as the Black Dahlia case. That's coming up. I'll be here till 2 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Oh, you know what happened? I don't have the rejoin music up. So I did this last week, Lisa. This was my fault last week.
Yes, it was.
And it's my fault again.
Yes, it is.
But thanks, David. It is, let's see, 12:11 almost. Oh, my gosh. We're getting a late start here. We're, like, late every segment.
Well, stop talking so much.
You are the talkative one. in this hour, we're going to listen to Nick Carter, Master Detective. He was one of the best detectives on the radio. Very long-running radio series. And then in our next hour, Somebody Knows, Good Murder Mystery. But right now, we're going to play our song. It's called Oldies But Goodies, right?
Right.
Cat's Pride, Oldies But Goodies.
Those oldies but goodies reminds me of you. The song of the past, bring back memories of you.
Yeah, you know what, Lisa? That was much better.
All right, thanks. So this is our Oldies But Goodies, and this hour we're playing a show, Nick Carter, Master Detective, from August of 1948, and a song that was a top hit in August of 1948 is called You Call Everybody Darlin' by Al Trace and his orchestra.
Darlin' or darlin', you call everybody darlin'.
You call everybody darling, and everybody calls you darling too. You don't mean what you're saying, it's just a game you're playing, but you'll find someone else can play the game as well as you. If you call everybody darling, then love won't come a-knockin' at your door. And as the years roll by, you'll sit and wonder why nobody calls you darling anymore.
You call everybody darling.
You're so fickle.
And everybody calls you darling too.
You don't mean what you're saying, it's just a game you're playing, but you'll find someone else can play the game as well as you.
If you call everybody darling,
you'll find out.
Then love won't come a-knocking at your door.
No more.
And as the years roll by, you'll sit and wonder why nobody calls you darling anymore.
A DJ now.
Yes, right.
Well, like a disc jockey.
That was Everybody Darling. You Call Everybody Darling by Al Trace and his orchestra. August
it's
of
like
1948.
A DJ show. Wow.
That's right. It's like a DJ show. Like a regular radio show.
Yeah, it's like a DJ show.
I think I love the idea of adding a little layer to our radio shows.
Yeah,
and
because
adding
it was your idea.
Of course.
You
but
were.
Adding some of the music from that time period.
I was dead set against it. folks. I was dead set against playing music, but Lisa, like, she just trumped me on this.
Trumped
you. She's like,
you.
Listen, we're playing music.
No,
we're not
I didn't
doing
do that, and we actually came up with this together, but I do think it does add another piece of information, another layer of what's going on in the world when you have, when you play the song, and it sort of sets up what we're going to do, because next we're going to be playing Nick Carter, Master Detective, which is from August 22nd, 1948. That happened to hit number one in August of 1948.
You call everybody darling.
That's right.
Wow. All right. Well, we'll play Nick Carter, Master Detective, right after these words. All right. Nick Carter, Master Detective, one of the best detective shows from the golden age of radio. And like Sherlock Holmes, Nick Carter solved cases too tough for police. That earned him the moniker Master Detective. Now, Lon Clark played Nick Carter through the entire run from 1943 until 1955. And his assistant, Patsy Bowen, was played by two different actresses, Helen Choate and Charlotte Manson. Scubby Wilson, the reporter, was played by John Kane. There were 13 years on the radio with this. 13-year run. Always starred Lon Clark. And there were three movies on Nick Carter, played by Walter Pidgeon for MGM. But right now we have a radio broadcast from August 22nd, 1948. This is called The Case of the Red Arrow. Here's Lon Clark in part one of Nick Carter, Master Detective.
New post-war Old Dutch cleanser, famous for chasing dirt, presents Nick Carter, famous for chasing crime. Every week at this time, two great names are joined as new post-war Old Dutch cleanser brings you one of the most resourceful and daring characters in all detective fiction, Nick Carter, Master Detective.
Nick, she said she locked all the doors and windows, but don't you think we ought to check them, just in case?
You're right, Patsy. I'm going to check them right now.
Good.
Of course, I don't really believe this Indian legend.
Somebody screamed. Do you suppose...
Come on, Patsy, hurry.
Yeah.
Locked, confound it. Well...
Oh, Nick, look.
Yes. We're too late.
She's dead.
Yes, Patsy. With a red arrow in her heart.
Now, the case of the Red Arrow. Today's adventure starring Lon Clark as Nick Carter. Brought to you by new post-war Old Dutch cleanser. As Miss Harriet Hartwell removes the hairpins from her iron gray hair before going to bed, it's a stern, determined face that looks back at her from the mirror. The face of a woman not easily frightened, even by a sound heard often during the past few weeks in the historic old Hartwell mansion.
Oh, for heaven's sake, not again. Where's that gun? What is it?
Oh, I saw it again, Harriet. I was letting the dog out, and there it was.
Oh, fiddlesticks.
I tell you, I saw him with the feathers in his hair and the bow and arrow.
Oh, you saw nothing of the kind. Now, stop that noise. You too, Hannibal. You hear me, sir?
What's the matter, Aunt Harriet? Is it the ghost again?
Oh, yes. Abby says she saw him again.
I did.
Here, Gerald, take the gun and look around.
Okay, Aunt Harriet.
I heard the screaming. He's come again, ain't he?
Never mind, Lisa. Go back to bed.
I told you not to plow up that grave. He'll keep coming back until one
go
night...
Go back to bed, Lisa. Unless you want me to look for a new housekeeper in the morning.
I'm going. But remember, I warned you.
Now, Abby, you stop that blubbering right now.
There's no one in the back of the house, Aunt Harriet.
Of course not. There never is. Oh, Harriet, Harriet, please. Let's get out before it's too late.
What? Let a dead Indian run me out of my own house? I should say not.
Perhaps you only imagined it, Miss.
I did not. I tell you, I saw him. Oh, Harriet, listen to me. You can't fight a ghost.
Oh, can't I, huh? Well, I'm going to make this particular ghost wish he'd never been born.
Of course, you know, Miss Hartwell, chasing ghosts isn't exactly my line.
Yeah, Nick, but maybe it would be interesting for a change.
Well, maybe you have something there, Patsy. Tell me about the ghost anyway, Miss Hartwell.
Well, the old Hartwell place is about 50 miles up the river.
I see.
And when my great-great-grandfather, General Absalom Hartwell, built it back in 1815,
The Indians around that section were pretty riled about it.
Why?
Well, because they had a burial ground on the property and they considered it sacred soil.
I see.
Now, among the graves was that of Red Arrow, one of their greatest chiefs.
Uh-huh.
And the Indians warned that his spirit would come back to avenge the insult.
And did it?
Well, something did. Because one morning, the general was found dead in his bedroom with a red arrow in his heart.
Golly. And I suppose the ghost has been appearing ever since?
Well, no. Not until I moved in 3 months ago.
Oh?
You see, for the past 30 years, no one has lived in the house but Letha Mabry, the caretaker.
Yeah?
Now she's my housekeeper.
Yeah, but I wonder why the big chief is on the warpath again after all these years.
Well, according to Letha, when I put in my rose garden, I accidentally had his grave plowed up.
Did you ever see the ghost yourself, Miss Hartwell?
Well, yes, one time. But when I threw a brass inkwell at him, he ran into my bedroom and disappeared.
Well, what happened then?
Well, I went right in after him, but there was nobody there, and all the doors and windows were locked.
But both your housekeeper, Miss Abby, have seen it several times, is that right?
Yes, we've all seen it, except Gerald.
Gerald, that's the nephew who was visiting you last night.
Yes, he usually comes out for weekends. Gerald is the only close relative I have, and he knows he'll get my money someday, so he tries to keep on the good side of me.
Well, Miss Abby's a relative, too, isn't she?
Oh, she's a second cousin twice removed.
Oh.
But both she and Gerald know I'm not leaving her much.
Miss Hartwell, what do you think a private investigator can do against a ghost?
Ghost, my foot. Someone's deliberately trying to frighten me, and I want to know who it is and why they're doing it.
Well, I'll tell you what. Patsy and I'll drive up there tonight, stay a few days.
Good.
But please, don't tell the others who I am.
Whatever you say, Mr. Carter.
From now on, it's Professor Carter, Miss Hartwell. I'm a scholar who's interested in psychic manifestations, okay?
Very well, Professor Carter.
Oh, gee, this is going to be interesting.
Yes, Patsy, but not only for us. With a little luck, I think we can make it plenty interesting for Mr. Ghost. Yes, there is definitely an aura about this house conducive to psychic phenomena. Wouldn't you say so, Miss Bowen?
Absolutely, Professor.
Well, it's 11 o'clock. I think I'll turn in.
Yes, it's time we all went to bed. Oh, did you take the dog out, Abby?
Oh, yes. Hannibal and I had a lovely walk in the garden.
Did Letha show you your room, Miss Bowen?
Yes, thank you, at the head of the stairs.
Oh, your room is on the ground floor, Professor Carter. I thought you'd prefer that.
Well, that's very thoughtful of you.
Did I tell you that the ghost has never been seen upstairs?
Why, no. How very interesting.
Mm.
Yes, that's why nobody but Aunt Harriet will sleep down here. Well, night all.
Oh, wait a minute, Gerald.
Hmm?
I'm going up, too. I don't like to walk through the hall alone. Not after last night.
Oh, Mr. Nesbitt.
Yes, Professor?
You say that every time the ghost has appeared, you made an immediate search and found all the doors and windows locked on the inside.
Yes, every time. I happened to be here on each occasion.
Oh, imagine what would have happened if we'd been alone.
That's what I was thinking.
Oh.
Well, good night.
Good night. And good luck with your ghost chasing.
Good night, Professor. Good night, Miss Bowen.
Good night, Miss Abby. Mr. Nesbitt.
I think I'll retire, too. Is there anything you need, Professor Carter?
No, thank you, Miss Hartwell. Patsy and I'll sit here for a while and watch for our friend, the Redskin.
Well, I just hope you catch him.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, Professor, what do you think?
It's hard to tell, Patsy. But the fact that the ghost always appears on this floor, and everybody but Miss Harriet sleeps upstairs, is a help.
Yes, from this room you can keep an eye on the front stairway. And there aren't any back stairs.
That's what I mean. They're all panned in. Even Miss Harriet herself.
Hmm?
There's only one door to her room, and I can see that from here.
What do you think of her, Nick?
Miss Harriet? Oh, she's a great old girl. I'd hate to be that ghost when she catches it.
That's the way I feel.
Well,
Letha, I didn't see you come in.
No. You and the professor was talking. Will you be wanting anything else before I go up to bed?
No, thank you, Letha. Did you lock up?
Yes, sir. I tested every door and window. Not that it will do any good against him.
You've lived here a long time, haven't you?
30 years. Most of it all alone in this house, just like it was my own. And there wasn't never no trouble with him till she moved in.
You mean Miss Harriet?
I do. Moving the furniture around, things that ain't been changed in 100 years. Plowing up the burial ground. boss and everybody, like as if she was a queen.
Well, if you feel that way, why don't you quit?
Me leave this house? No, sorry. I got more right here than she has, and I'll be here after she's gone.
What makes you think Miss Harriet will go, Lisa?
She'll go. Chief Red Arrow will take care of that.
You mean the way he took care of old General Hartwell?
That ain't for me to say. I'm going up now. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Ruth, she's a pleasant person to have around.
Oh, wonder how far she'd go to get Miss Harriet out of here.
That's what I was thinking.
No, Patsy, this place must be worth a lot of money.
No.
Collection of Indian relics alone are the finest I ever saw.
And did you see those things upstairs? Helmets, suits of armor, crossbows, antique guns.
Oh, you mean the European collection?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Miss Harriet said they belonged to her grandfather. Most of them are museum pieces.
I've been thinking something, Nick, not to change the subject.
What?
Letha said she locked all the doors and windows.
Oh, don't
but...
worry. I'm going to check them myself.
What was that?
Miss Harriet, come on, Patsy.
Yeah.
Miss Harriet! Miss Harriet, what's the matter?
Oh, Nick, she doesn't answer.
Did you scream, Miss Bowen?
No, it was your Aunt Harriet.
Well, maybe she fainted.
Miss Harriet isn't the fainting type.
Oh, wasn't that Harriet, Professor Carter?
Yes, it was, Miss Abby. Oh. Confounded, the door's locked. Stand back, Patsy. I'll have to break it in.
Don't you dare. I won't let you.
You haven't anything to say about it, Letha.
No, no. Get away from there. Stop that.
Get her off my back, Miss.
Get that.
Carter, now calm down, Letha.
Take your hands off me.
Calm down.
Oh, Professor. It's Harriet.
Oh, Nick, she's dead.
Yes, Patsy. With a red arrow through her heart.
A red arrow, symbol of the long-dead Indian chief, protrudes from the chest of the woman who dug up his grave. A woman who was alone in a room with every door and window shut. We'll see what happens in just a moment.
All right, we're going to see what happens in just a moment, Lisa.
I'm waiting.
Nick Carter, Master Detective, we'll get back to it right after these words.
Back to WGN Radio Theater with Earl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
You know what, Lisa? I'm very excited about the Classic Radio Club because people have been joining and enjoying it. We've been getting tons of texts, and I've had some calls from people. And the Classic Radio Club, folks, is something you should join. I created it for all of our listeners. Just go to ClassicRadioClub.com. Lisa joined, and your dad keeps stealing your CD sets.
Well, you know, we're kind of a joint venture here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the
all
good thing about it is we can share. They're on CD.
Right.
So they're easy to pass around, share with a friend, or give to a friend, even as a gift.
Right.
I think it's especially great because it comes right to your door once a month, and you don't have to seek it out. It's just like a surprise once a month. You get a gift to yourself or to your friend, and I think that's really special. We don't do that anymore. There's not a lot of things that come via mail anymore.
Yeah.
I love getting packages, don't you?
Right. It comes in a nice yellow manila envelope.
Oh, well,
padded
if it's
envelope.
Yellow, then yeah.
Yeah, you there it is. There's your Classic Radio Club. Every single month, what you do, folks, is you get 5 CDs every single month sent to you, 10 classic radio shows, the best shows from my library. I'm hand-picking the most important, the most interesting, the most fun, and the best quality with the biggest stars from the golden age of radio in Hollywood. And we're sending to people these 5 CDs every single month. Now, there's never a duplicate show. And when you join as a member, you get your first collection of 5 CDs for only $4.95. $4.99 plus shipping and handling. And it comes to your door. We'll rush it right out to you when you join. And then every month, it's $10 more. It's $14.99. But the value of the 5 CDs is $39.95. So you're really getting a great deal. And for only $14.99 a month, you get 5 CDs with 10 classic radio shows. Plus, I'm writing very copious liner notes that I send with the CDs. I think you will really enjoy being part of the club.
And they sound just as good as the shows that we play on here on WGN. So check it out. There is no place that you can find radio shows other than here on WGN that you can get these kind of radio shows with this kind of quality.
Yep. I have 100,000 shows under license, and I'm picking the best of the best of the best and sending them to our Classic Radio Club members. Now, how do you join? Just go to ClassicRadioClub.com. classicradioclub.com. So go on your computer and log on classicradioclub.com. Okay, now it's time for the conclusion to Nick Carter, Master Detective.
Now back to The Case of the Red Arrow. Today's adventure with Nick Carter, brought to you by new post-war Old Dutch cleanser. Only a moment has passed since Nick broke into the locked bedroom to find Miss Harriet lying on the floor with a red arrow in her heart.
There's only one door to this room, and the killer didn't come in or leave that way. I've been watching that.
How about the windows, Nick?
This one's locked on the inside.
So this one, Nick.
And the killer must still be in the room.
Oh.
What's this door?
That's a closet. But if he's hiding there, he'd...
No, nothing here but a few dresses.
I tell you, it was Chief Red Arrow. He don't need no doors, no windows. He walks through the wall.
If you want to believe that, Letha, go ahead. But I don't take any stock in ghosts. Not yet, anyway.
Really, Professor Carter, that's an odd remark for a man who says he's interested in psychic phenomena.
I'm a private investigator, Nesbitt.
A detective?
That's right, Miss Abby.
Nothing must be touched until the police arrive. Will you phone them, Patsy?
Of course, Nick.
Oh, I knew something awful would happen. I warned her. I begged her to leave this house.
You should have known those were the wrong tactics to use on Aunt Harriet, Miss Abby.
She hadn't ought to have come here in the first place, changing things around, plowing up graves.
No ghost did this, Letha. And no human being could have gone out and locked the windows after him on the inside. So it's someone who's in this house right now.
You don't mean one of us.
That's exactly what I mean, Nesbitt. And I'm making it my business to find out which one of you it is.
You expect to find a secret panel in the wall, Mr. Carter?
Could be, Sheriff. They all sound pretty solid.
Oh, but Nick, secret panels. You don't find those things in real life.
Yeah, not nowadays, Miss Bowen, but this house is 133 years old.
The sheriff's right, Patsy. But there doesn't seem to be any panel in these walls.
You know, Mr. Carter, maybe what we ought to look for first is motive.
Yeah. Well, first there's Letha. She certainly resented Miss Harriet's being here.
They all had motives, Patsy.
Except Miss Abby.
Even she might have hated Miss Harriet.
Hmm?
Couldn't have been too easy living here as a poor relation.
No, but she could always leave if she wanted to.
Yeah, how about money? Miss Harriet was rich, and if Miss Abby thought she'd be the heir...
No, Sheriff. Miss Abby knew that practically all the money goes to the nephew, Gerald Nesbitt.
Nesbitt, huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And Gerald Nesbitt is the only person in the house who never saw the ghost, even though he says he just happened to be here every time it showed up.
That does look suspicious.
Yeah.
But just now, I'm interested in this arrow...
Yeah, looks like a homemade job. No stone arrowhead tied under a new shaft?
Taped on, Sheriff. And very neatly, too.
I've seen that sort of tape before, Nick. Dressmakers use it. You can get it at any dime store.
I know, Patsy, but it's the way the tape is wound down that interests me.
Huh? Mm-hmm.
A very distinctive design. Yes?
Oh, Mr. Carter.
Yes, Miss Abby.
I left my glasses in here.
Oh, there they are, Miss Abby. On the table.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Carter, you don't really think that one of us...
I'm afraid I do, Miss Abby.
Oh, but we were all upstairs.
Yeah, Mr. Carter was trying to find a secret passageway in the walls, but didn't get nowhere.
Oh, I'm sure there couldn't be anything like...
Miss Abby, what's the matter?
Oh, there he is again.
Good grief, Carter. She's fainted.
Here, Miss Abby, drink this.
Oh, thank you. Did I faint?
You said you saw something.
Oh, yes. Chief Red Arrow's ghost.
Where? At the window?
No. In the closet.
The closet, huh?
Yes, the dresses moved as if someone were hiding there. And then... Then I saw a hand.
Now you just imagined it. There ain't nobody in here.
No. I saw it.
Maybe this is what we're looking for, Sheriff.
What do you mean, Nick?
The walls in the room were solid, but...
Hey, that sounds hollow.
There's some clothes hooks on the back of the closet wall. Maybe if we pull one of them... No, not this one either.
I Golly, right.
A hidden stairway going upstairs.
So that's how the killer got in and out.
Let's see where it goes up to.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, these stairs are narrow, aren't they?
Say, what's that laying there in the steps?
A blanket. And an Indian headdress with feathers.
The ghost costume.
Right, Patsy, let's go on up.
Yeah. No wonder we didn't see anybody using the front stairs.
There's another door at the top.
Yeah. To where's the leader?
Apparently we're in another closet. You let me push these clothes out of the way and we'll go into the room.
I think these are men's clothes.
Say, what the...
Well,
yeah, what's
where did you people come from?
Well, you ought to know, sonny boy.
What do you mean?
Well, you come
wait
up here...
Sheriff, wait. Nesbitt, you were the first one to come upstairs just before the murder. Did you come directly to this room?
Yes. Why?
Did anybody else come through here?
No, of course not.
So, that does it, young fella. You're under arrest for the murder of your aunt. Well, I'm blamed if I know why you wanted me to come back out here this morning, Nick.
I want to take a look at the outside of the house, Sheriff.
Huh?
Now, these are the windows to Miss Harriet's room.
Yes, so what?
Letha's room is on the other side of the house, the back. Miss Abby's windows are directly above here. And that's Nesbitt's room, above and to the right.
Well, what difference does it make? We know he did it, and we got him safe in the county jail.
Yeah, it won't hurt him to stay there for a day or two. It'll throw the real killer off.
Darn it, Nick. Nesbitt's the killer. Those hidden stairs were the only way into Miss Harriet's room.
Yeah, that's right.
And nobody but Nesbitt could have used them at that time. He admitted it.
Right again. So the arrow must have been shot from outside the house.
Through those locked windows?
Not necessarily. Here. Look at this tree, Sheriff.
Huh?
It's right in front of Miss Harriet's windows. Not 6 feet away from them.
Well, if you think one of the women climbed down that tree from upstairs, you're crazy.
That isn't what I'm driving at. Here. Take a look at these marks on the inside of the place where it forks, about 5 feet from the ground.
Yeah, that's funny. The tree forks three ways, and something's been pressed into the bark inside each fork.
Yeah, something's been wedged firmly between those three forks, and recently.
Right. Well, you can tell that those marks are new.
Sheriff, did you ever see a crossbow?
Crossbow? What's that?
A medieval weapon with a stock like a shotgun and a bow mounted crosswise on the front end.
Oh, sure, yeah.
More powerful than an ordinary bow. And it can be aimed more accurately.
Well, yeah, there's one in the collection upstairs. After it's cocked, you pull the trigger to shoot the arrow.
That's the weapon I mean.
Oh, then you think that crossbow was wedged in the fork of this tree pointing into Miss Harriet's room?
I wouldn't be surprised. Could easily be pulled loose from the tree fork and hauled into an upstairs window with a strong cord. And a cord around the trigger could pull the trigger by remote control.
Well, maybe so, but still couldn't shoot through a closed and locked window without breaking it. You can't get away from that, Nick.
Maybe not, Sheriff, but I'm doing my best.
What are you two fooling around out here for?
Suppose I ask you the same question, Letha. Isn't it time you were getting dinner?
I'm doing the washing. Miss Abby always tends to the cooking on wash day.
I see.
That girl you brung with you is helping her, if you're interested.
Looking for something, Letha?
I'm looking for my clothes prop, that's what. Somebody moved it.
Wait a minute. I can't enough my clothes prop. That's a pole about 7 feet long, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Used to prop up the clothesline and hold the clothes off the ground.
Here it is. Now, how in the name of common sense did it get around here in the tall grass?
Here, let me see that.
I catch the one that threw it out here.
Never mind, Letha. I'll catch that person for you. Come on, Sheriff. I've got the answer now.
If you have another big knife, Miss Abby, I'll help you shred that cabbage.
Oh, I'm almost through, Miss Bowen. But if you'd like to take a look at the soup...
I better get a long spoon to stir it with.
There's one in the drawer of the cabinet over there.
Thanks. This one that's been mended?
Yes. The handle came loose and I put some tape around it. I'm very good at fixing things.
What? Why, that's the same kind of tape that was used to make the arrow that...
What did you say?
Well, the way this tape is wound around the spoon handle, that complicated way,
That's the same as what was on that arrow.
I wish you hadn't noticed that, Miss Bowen.
It was you. You, Miss Abby.
Yes, Miss Bowen. It was I.
But you had no reason to kill her.
No reason? How would you like to be a poor relation, always taking orders, watching her buy the best of everything, and having to get along with nothing yourself? I made up my mind that I was going to have nice things, too.
What? You killed her for the money? But surely you know that practically everything goes to Gerald.
Not if he's convicted of killing her, it doesn't.
What?
The law doesn't let a murderer profit by his crime. And I'm the only other relative Harriet had. I'll get it all.
Maybe you would have, but now...
You won't tell on me, Miss Bowen.
What?
You won't ever tell.
Miss Abby, put down that knife. But no, Miss Abby, please.
Trapped in a corner of the old-fashioned kitchen, Patsy has no chance to get past Miss Abby as the old lady advances with a heavy knife in her hand. In the kitchen of the historic Hartwell Mansion, Patsy is alone with a murderess with a heavy knife in her hand who advances slowly as she says...
You won't tell on me, Miss Bowen.
What?
You won't ever tell.
Miss Abby, put down that knife. What? No, Miss Abby, please. No!
Take that if you don't mind.
No, I'll kill you, too.
All right, Miss Abby. Be a good girl.
Let go of me.
Might hurt yourself.
Let go of me.
Pull away like that.
All right, I've got the knife, Sheriff. Hold on to Miss Abby, will you?
Sure will.
Nick, she did it. She killed Miss Harriet.
I know, Patsy. Sheriff and I were just coming in to arrest her.
And she wanted Gerald to be blamed. That's why the ghost never appeared unless he was here.
No, it was you who paraded around dressed up like an old Chief Red Arrow, was it, Miss Abby?
Very well, I'll admit it.
Yes.
Got the idea when Letha warned Harriet that the chief's ghost would come back for revenge. And when I discovered that secret stairway, I knew just how it could be done.
Yes. That stairway to Gerald's room made it appear that he was the only person who could have shot Miss Harriet from inside the house. When actually you shot her from outside the window.
But, Nick, how could she do that?
A crossbow, Patsy.
What?
Wedged in the fork of a tree outside the window. Fired by pulling a string tied to the trigger. Then quickly pulled up into Miss Abby's own room with a cord tied around the stock.
But I don't see how in the world...
The arrow was aimed at the center of Miss Harriet's window. When Miss Harriet opened the window for the night, the light inside the room threw her shadow on the tree trunk outside.
Oh.
And that's when Miss Abby pulled the string.
What a setup.
Hey, what if we hadn't found that secret stairway, though? Then there wouldn't have been no evidence against Joe.
You almost didn't find it, you idiots.
What?
Even after I put the blanket and headdress on the stairs for you to discover. So I had to pretend I saw something there, so you'd look closer.
Well, Miss Abby, I got a nice cell waiting for you down in my jail.
Oh.
Awful sorry there ain't no secret panel for you to monkey with. But I guess you'll make out somehow.
Nick, I still don't see how Miss Abby managed to close that window after shooting Miss Harriet with that arrow.
It was easy, Patsy.
What?
She merely leaned out of her own window and pushed it shut with a clothes prop.
The clothes prop?
Yeah, she took it upstairs early in the evening. And when she was finished with it, she threw it out into the yard.
But, Nick, Miss Harriet's window was locked.
Yeah, but you remember when we broke into the room just after Miss Harriet was killed? It was Miss Abby who rushed to the window to see whether it was locked.
What? You mean she locked it then?
She did.
Well, I'll be darned. And right in front of us.
Oh, it was a clever scheme, all right.
Oh, but why were you so sure that Gerald hadn't come down that hidden stairway and murdered his aunt?
Because I knew Miss Abby was lying when she pretended to see someone in the closet.
How did you know?
Because if anyone had come into the closet from the hidden stairway, the secret door would have creaked so loudly that we couldn't have missed hearing it.
Oh, gee. She must have planned that murder for months in advance.
Oh, I'm sure she did. But she lost her head when she tried to kill you.
Oh.
Since she couldn't cover that up, it would have been a bad mistake.
Well, I'll say. Not only for her, but for me. Thanks for not letting her make it, Nick.
You're quite welcome, Betsy. I'd hate to have to break in a new assistant.
What? Why, you... Carter!
Can you tell us something about the adventure new post-war old Dutch cleanser is going to bring us next week, Nick?
Indeed I can, Mike. Next week we're going to meet a brand new version of an old horse and buggy racket. It was so streamlined that it murdered 3 people.
And the only clue to the solution was the fact that a lot of people suddenly started wearing new glasses.
Well, that certainly sounds interesting. What do you call the adventure, Nick?
I call it The Case of the Failing Eyes.
Nick Carter, Master Detective, presented each week at this time by the Cudahy Packing Company, is produced and directed by Jock McGregor and is copyright by Street & Smith Publications, Incorporated. Charlotte Manson is featured as Patsy. Today's script was written by Jim Parsons. Original music is played by Henry Silverne. This program is fictional, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental. This is Michael Fitzmaurice saying, when minutes count, use new post-war old Dutch cleanser. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
You know, it was kind of mutual. Everyone was very mutual about that broadcasting
right,
system.
Right, and it was very clean.
Yeah.
Cleanser
old
clean.
Old Dutch cleanser.
Cleanser
yeah.
clean.
You see someone on their knees like scrubbing.
Yeah, like scrubbing the floor.
Scrubbing away, you know, with old Dutch cleanser. Yeah. I think... Try to think. Well, Ajax.
That's what I was thinking.
We had Ajax growing up.
I'm not sure. Still have Ajax.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I ever saw
with those Brillo pads.
Old Dutch cleanser, though. But
you probably didn't cleanse much.
I don't clean much.
That's what I was thinking.
Because
that's why you have children.
Well,
so they can clean for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Actually, I do most of the cleaning around the house.
Does who else does the cleaning?
Well, it's just me and CJ.
Yeah, and I'm guessing
it's just
he
the
doesn't
two of
do
us.
It.
Live, my son, who's 20, and I live together, and he helps, you know. But
does
I
he?
Do the laundry, and but I have a cleaning person that comes and helps because it's just two guys, you know.
Yeah.
And
everybody
you know
needs a little
be.
Help. No, and, I don't actually.
I was looking at my credit card the other day. Curtis, are you? You got the microphone on there?
I do now.
Oh, hang on a second. Wrong one. How's that?
There
better.
There we go. Yep.
You know, I was looking at my credit card the other day, and I'm looking at it, and it says, and it basically read like this:
pizza,
breakfast,
pizza,
out, lunch, out, dinner, out. You know, every single day, pretty much, because I can't cook.
Right.
So he and I go to breakfast, and then we'll maybe go to lunch. And then a little
then
later in the day,
dinner.
He's like, hey, where would you like to go to dinner? Like, I went to Kobe, which is right down the block in Algonquin from me, where down the block from where I live.
Well, when you make a lot of money, you can spend it on a lot of food.
A lot of
That's
money.
All.
And I can't cook. He can't cook.
Right.
So we just go out a lot.
Yeah.
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 And so
no
that's,
problem. Just put the charge card out there.
Yeah. I mean, works. The charge card works.
So far.
Do you cook, Curtis?
Every once in a while.
Yeah?
Basic stuff, though.
What can you cook?
Pancakes, grilled cheese.
Macaroni.
Like macaroni and cheese.
Like the guy stuff. That's
Soup.
What guys can make.
Frozen Soup. Dinners.
Yeah, that's right.
Microwave.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sort of like you, right, Lisa?
No, I'm cooking right now as we speak.
Are you?
I'm cooking. I have a big brunch in my house in the morning, and I'm on it.
Very good. All right, well, that was Nick Carter, Master Detective, with The Case of the Red Arrow, starring Lon Clark from August 22nd, 1948. Hope you enjoyed that. Let's take a quick break. Then it's more on the WGN Radio Theater. Just been late every single segment of this show.
You should stay right on schedule.
I don't know what it is. I think it's just that you're just... You know, chit-chat.
Yeah, I'm sure it's me. I'm pretty sure it's Curtis's fault.
It is. It's probably Curtis's fault.
He just keeps talking.
It's not Shante's fault because she's just doing her thing in there.
I know.
She's not making us late.
That's because you give her a lot to do.
I know. All right, well, in the next hour, we're going to have Somebody Knows the Elizabeth Short murder case. I'll tell you all about that. It's a very interesting program. That's coming your way next hour. Our text in line, 312-981-7200. We love getting your texts.
Back to WGN Radio Theater with Earl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
Thanks, Roger. All right, 10 minutes after 1 o'clock in the morning, and it's hour 3. We have Somebody Knows in this hour from 1950. That's coming up in just a minute, but right now we're going to play Cat's Pride, Oldies But Goodies.
Those oldies but goodies. Reminds me of you, the song of the
this oldie but goodie song is from August of 1950.
Yeah.
And this song we all know because it is Mona Lisa by Nat King Cole.
Mona Lisa Smile?
Yes.
By Nat King Cole?
Mm-hmm.
Mona Lisa.
I was going to say,
maybe
I could
we'll just sing it. Yeah, we'll just sing it. I think it'll be better.
All right.
Go ahead, Lisa. I'm Mona and you're Lisa.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely that I've blamed you? For that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile. Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there and they die there. Are you warm? Are you just a cold, lonely, lovely work of art? Tempt a lover, Mona Lisa. Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there and they die. Are you warm? Are you real? Mona Lisa, are just a cold, lonely, lovely work of art? Mona Lisa.
So you're Mona, I'm Lisa, but that was Mona Lisa by Nat King Cole. That was from August of 1950. I think that was a number one hit during that month. So now we are set up for our next radio show, Somebody Knows, which is from August 24th of 1950.
That's coming up right after these words. All right, it is time for Somebody Knows. This was a mystery series, Lisa. Actually, it was a summer replacement for Suspense in 1950. Now, it only ran 8 episodes. It was a summer replacement, so by the time it ran its 8 episodes, Suspense was back from its sort of hiatus.
Do you have all 8 episodes?
I do. I have all 8 episodes. And probably the most famous episode in the series was the one we are about to play. It is the murder case of Elizabeth Short. She was the victim in the notorious Black Dahlia case. And there were not only a TV movie, but there was a big budget film made about this case. I do not believe it was ever solved, but the whole, idea of this show was that producers, they would say right at the beginning that we will pay you $5,000. Now, you're going back to 1950, $5,000 in 1950. It's a lot of money now. It was a ton of money back then. They would pay $5,000 to anyone who would send in a clue that solved the dramatized crime case. Pretty interesting, yeah. Right? And as I said, this particular episode is probably the most famous in the series. It's from August 24th, 1950, the Elizabeth Short murder case. Harry Bartell stars in this. Here's part one now of Somebody Knows.
Suspense, which is heard on Thursday nights at this hour, is taking its customary summer holiday. Suspense returns to the air 1 week from now on Thursday, August 31st. Ladies and gentlemen, a $5,000 reward will be offered on the program immediately following this announcement.
You out there, you who think you've committed the perfect crime, the perfect murder, that there are no clues, no witnesses, that your identity is unknown, listen.
Somebody knows.
Yes, you, wherever you may be, no matter where you're hiding, somewhere, sometime, someone listening to this program is going to bring you to justice. Yes?
Somebody knows.
The Columbia Broadcasting System presents Somebody Knows, a program conceived in the public interest, dedicated to aiding the forces of law and order in the solution of this nation's unsolved crimes.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to recreate for you tonight all the known facts in an actual unsolved murder. Somewhere, someone among you has had contact with a killer or killers. Someone whose identity need never be known has seen evidence or possesses information that can lead to the solution of this crime.
In the public interest, the Columbia Broadcasting System offers $5,000 reward for evidence or information leading to the arrest and conviction of the killer in this unsolved murder.
We ask you then to please listen carefully, for you may be the one to win this reward.
Somebody knows.
It may be you. And now we open the files on one of this nation's unsolved murders. It's homicide file number DR295771, the Los Angeles, California Police Department. The unsolved murder of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. It is approximately 6:45 a.m., the morning of Wednesday, January 15, 1947. In the southwest section of Los Angeles, California, in the houseless 3900 block on South Norton Avenue, a vacant, weed-overgrown lot is barely visible in the quiet darkness just before dawn. Then an old battered sedan speeds south on Norton Avenue, suddenly swings sharply into the curb opposite that vacant lot. The car remains at that location for approximately 3 minutes. During that time, the driver makes two hasty trips across the paved sidewalk between the car and the vacant lot. Then, when the task is completed, the driver re-enters the car and speeds away. It is now 11:05 on the morning of Wednesday, January 15, 1947. A monitor on a police complaint switchboard in the communications division of the Los Angeles Police Department answers an incoming call.
Los Angeles Police Department Complaint Division.
Hello, I want to report a body.
Body, ma'am?
Yes, a nude body. It's lying there just off the sidewalk in the vacant lot.
Where is this lot, ma'am?
It's in the 3900 block on South Norton Avenue.
Thank you. I'll have somebody out there right away.
It is now 11:07, Wednesday morning, January 15th, 1947. Radio car 302, manned by officers F.S. Perkins and W.E. Fitzgerald of the University Division, is cruising in the southwestern section of Los Angeles.
Code 2, a 390 down on the west side of Norton Avenue, 3900 block.
Uh-oh, crank it
code
up, Fitz.
Code 2, a 390 down on the west side of Norton, 3900 block. Car 302, acknowledge.
302, got it.
In response to the Code 2 broadcast, the radio car proceeds immediately to the 3900 block on Norton Avenue. Pulls over to the curb on the west side of the street. Good Lord.
Yeah. Yeah.
The nude body of a young woman is lying face up in the weeds, a few inches from the sidewalk. Her face and forehead have been brutally slashed and beaten, the body itself horribly mutilated. It has been cut completely in two.
Better notify university detectives. Homicide's going to have a job on his hands.
The officers report their findings to the University Police Division. What is to prove to be one of the greatest manhunts in the history of the Los Angeles Police Department is underway. Early efforts to identify the victim of the murder prove unsuccessful. And at 7:25 o'clock on the night of January 15th, 1947, an all-points broadcast is put out.
Attention all police officers, all cars and divisions. Wanted, identification of this person found murdered this AM. Description follows. Female, American, young, height 5'6", weight 118 pounds. All fingernails bitten to quick. Black hair recently henned. Eyes grayish green. Small nose uptipped slightly. High forehead and hairline. No earlobe.
Meanwhile, Dr. Frederick D. Newbar, chief autopsy surgeon of the coroner's office, makes a post-mortem examination that lasts 3 full hours. Then he reports,
the immediate cause of death was hemorrhage and shock due to concussion of the brain and lacerations of the face. There were rope marks around her neck, wrists, and ankles. These, along with the severe mutilations of the body, indicate the victim was probably tied and sadistically tortured before her death.
Fingerprints are taken at the morgue, and at 2 a.m. on the morning of January 16th, 1947, enlarged photographs are flashed by wire photo to the FBI in Washington.
Emergency, request immediate search.
And within 5 hours, a reply comes in from the FBI.
Positive identification of prints made from those recorded in this office, September 1943. Subject, Elizabeth Short. Age, that date, 19 years. Clerk at Camp Cook, Lompoc, California, Post Exchange. Arrested Santa Barbara, California, for drinking with soldiers in local cafe. Description follows. Height 5'6", weight 100.
With the positive identification of the victim as Elizabeth Short, the police investigation swings into high gear. Her mother, Mrs. Phoebe May Short of Medford, Massachusetts, is notified and within hours arrives at the Los Angeles airport.
Elizabeth wanted to get into pictures. That was her principal ambition. But she wrote to me 10 days ago that she was working in a naval hospital then in San Diego. I just can't believe that daughter is dead.
Sure, I know Beth Short. She was a swell kid. I'll say she had men friends, plenty of them. Gee, she was a pretty kid with that dark hair and that pretty white skin. And when she got all dolled up in that sheer black clothes, that's how she got her nickname, you know. That's why everybody called her the Black Dahlia.
The police now turn to San Diego in an attempt to determine the events that led to the killing of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. At her last known address in San Diego, information is obtained that promises to lead to a major break in the case.
Well, I haven't seen Beth for a week or so. I understood she was going back to Hollywood. Some man was going to drive her back. She called him Red. I think he used to be a Marine Corps flyer. Well, let's see. I think it was the night... Yes, the night of January 8th that she left to drive back with him.
Now the police have something more definite to go on. And for 3 days, a search is made for this unknown man. Then, on January 20th, 1947, at police headquarters in downtown Los Angeles...
Say, I understand you want to talk to me. I'm the man who left San Diego with Elizabeth Short. I first met her maybe a week or 10 days before Christmas. I was down there on a business trip. I saw her standing alone on a street corner, and you know how it is.
How well did you get to know her?
Well, we had dinner together a few times. It was about all.
What about this trip to Los Angeles?
Well, she heard that I was going there, and she asked if she could go with me. So I said, sure.
That was on the night of January 8th?
That was the night we left, yeah. January 8th.
When did you reach Los Angeles?
Well, it was about 6 o'clock the next night.
January 9th?
Yes, sir.
It doesn't take that long to drive here from San Diego.
No, we stayed at a motel the night before. Nothing wrong with it, you understand. There were different rooms. The reason was we didn't leave San Diego until late, and I wasn't in any hurry to get back here.
I see. What happened when you got into L.A.?
Well, as I said, we drove into L.A. about 6 o'clock that night, in the downtown section, that is. And while we were driving...
It is shortly before 6 in the evening, January 9th, 1947. Cars approaching the corner of 6th and Los Angeles streets in downtown Los Angeles. Within the car are Elizabeth Short, the man with whom she'd driven up from San Diego.
It's been a swell trip, Red. I sure appreciate the lift.
Forget it. It was a break for me having company on the way up. And as long as you had to come up anyway.
Yeah, I'm going to meet my sister. She... Say, isn't that the Greyhound bus station up ahead?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, can I stop there for a minute? I want to check my bags. It'll only take a minute.
Well, sure. Glad to...
Elizabeth Short takes her bags into the station and checks them there. All of her clothes, except those she's wearing, are in those bags. Then she gets back into the car, and they drive off. Several minutes later, the car pulls up in front of the Biltmore Hotel at 5th and Olive Streets.
Well, here's the Biltmore, Beth. That's where you want to go, isn't it?
Yeah. My sister should be in there now. Thanks again for everything. It was really swell. Coming back to town again soon?
I expect to, one of these days.
Well, be sure and give me a ring when you do. Try the hotel on Orange Drive. If I'm not there, they'll probably know where I am. So long.
Bye, Beth.
As the car drives away, Elizabeth Short stands there a moment alone, looking after it. Then she turns, walks into the lobby of the Biltmore Hotel. It is not until 6 days later, the morning of Wednesday, January 15th, 1947, that she's heard from again. When a nude, mutilated body is discovered lying in a vacant lot. The body that was once Elizabeth Short. It was once the gay and laughing Black Dahlia.
In just a moment, we'll continue with homicide file number DR295771 of the Los Angeles, California Police Department. The unsolved murder of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia.
They used to say Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's what I was
sometimes,
hearing.
Not all the time, but sometimes it did. The Los Angeles.
It's well,
weird.
That's how it
you
looks.
You don't hear that anymore, you know?
No.
All right, so we're listening to a very interesting program called Somebody Knows. This is the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Short, also known as the Black Dahlia case, from 1950. We'll get back to it in just a few minutes. Well, we're still late. 5 minutes late, Lisa.
Yeah, well, that's how we roll around here.
I don't like being late.
I'm pretty sure it's Roger's fault.
It is.
Back to WGN Radio Theater with Earl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
All right, thanks, Roger. All right, 1:40 in the morning, and this last segment here is about 16 minutes, so we've got to start, got to rock and roll here, Lisa. I know you're like a new DJ here on WGN,
yeah, well,
playing
you're,
these 19...
You're talking my language over 40s, there.
And she's like a DJ. She's become a Lisa DJ.
Well, I'm doing my homework. That's all. And I don't. I'm not using the one that you had suggested, Roger. I'm on my own.
I was just to get you started. That's all.
It was confusing, that website.
What?
Yeah.
Oh man.
We'll talk.
All right.
Yeah, you guys talk amongst yourselves.
Technologically challenged, are you?
No, I am not. Okay. You're talking to the wrong guy over here.
All right, well, we're listening to Somebody Knows, the Unsolved Murder of Elizabeth Short. Here's the conclusion.
Now back to Somebody Knows and a true case history of an actual murder.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we'll continue the rest of the factual information concerning homicide file number DR295771 in the records of the Los Angeles, California Police Department. The unsolved murder of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia.
Remember, $5,000 will be paid for information leading to the arrest and conviction of her killer.
Police check and recheck the story of the man who drove the Black Dahlia from San Diego to Los Angeles and dropped her off at the Biltmore Hotel at approximately 6 o'clock on the evening of January 9, 1947. Then this statement is issued.
We released this man with a clean bill of health. There's no evidence to... There's no evidence to connect him with the murder of Elizabeth Short.
Then, on the morning of January 24th, 1947, Robert Hyman, manager of a cafe at 1136 South Crenshaw Boulevard, tells the police...
It was early this morning. There was a trash can in front of the cafe, and I spotted a pair of shoes and a purse on top of the stuff there. The purse was large, made of some black plastic stuff, and the shoes looked like black suede. They were stuffed in the purse with the heels sticking out. Very high heels, you know. I didn't think anything of it at the time. And then it hit me. Maybe they were a clue to the Black Dahlia killing. Found her only about 20 blocks away, so I went back outside. City trash collector had already picked up all the stuff.
The police immediately make a widespread search for the trash collector's truck and finally located at the Los Angeles Byproducts Company. They talk to Mr. K.B. Schroeder, traffic manager of the disposal plant.
Yes, that truck came in here all right, but it's already dumped its load.
Where was it dumped?
Why, under that big pile of refuse over there. Trucks have been dumping stuff on it all week.
We'll still have to go through it. Find that purse and the shoe.
What? Oh, okay, sure thing. I'll stop the work and get all the men busy on it. We'll run the whole pile through a conveyor belt. May take a few hours, but the stuff will turn up if it's in there.
For several hours, the conveyor belt carries the refuse from the giant dump pile past the waiting men. Then, finally...
There they are. Stop the belts. I see them. There they are.
The purse and shoes are recovered from the trash and examined minutely. They answer the description of the purse and shoes worn by Elizabeth Short the night she walked alone into the Biltmore Hotel and disappeared. There are new heel tips on the shoes, and after a detailed, thorough search, the police finally locate the cobbler who had repaired them.
Sure, I put on those heels. Maybe 3-4 weeks ago. I remember the girl who brought them in, all right. Sure, I remember. But, she's not the one of those pictures. Nah, she's not the Black guy.
On the following day, January 25th, 1947, the first real break in the case occurs. A phone call comes into the homicide division.
Homicide, Hanson.
This is the United States Post Office calling. Postal Inspector Division.
Yes?
We have something down here that I think will interest you. Next from the Black Dahlia case.
Oh? What is it?
It's an envelope. And according to the address on it, it contains some personal belongings of Black Dahlia. Are you interested?
We'll be right over.
The envelope is examined in the postal inspector's office. It is addressed in letters clipped from newspaper accounts of the crime. The crude address reads, Los Angeles Examiner and other Los Angeles papers. Here is Dahlia's belongings. Letter to follow. The envelope is opened. Now here is Detective Sergeant Harry Hansen's statement as to its contents.
The envelope contained a black address book, a birth certificate, some pictures and calling cards. We're completely satisfied that the contents of that envelope are actually the belongings of the Black Dahlia.
It is the black address book, however, that is of primary importance to the police. Though 125 pages have been torn out of it, it still contains the names of some 75 men. Contact with these men is being begun immediately. Here are some typical results.
Well, I will admit I did pick her up. That was last October. I just took her to a drive-in. Never saw her again.
Well, I don't know anything about this. Oh, sure, I knew her. That is, I took her out twice. She phoned me a couple of times afterwards, asked for money, but I didn't see her again. I didn't know anything about this.
That's right. I went out with her a number of times. Sure I did. But, you know those things. I haven't seen her for maybe 6 months now. You know how those things are.
Two days after the receipt of the envelope and the little black book, another piece of mail comes into police headquarters. On the outside, in addition to the address, is this puzzling inscription. Sorry, Greenwich Village, not Cotton Club. Homicide officers then open the envelopes and examine the contents.
Here, Captain. Ordinary penny postcard.
Yes, there's something written on it. Let's see. Wait a minute. Now, listen to this. It says, here it is. Turning in Wednesday, January 29, 10 a.m. Had my fun at police. And it's signed Black Dahlia Avenger.
The card is written in ink with a bold, crude hand. There are no fingerprints on it. Postal authorities say that the new message was mailed the night before in downtown Los Angeles. Captain Jack Donahoe immediately publishes an answer to it.
To the killer of Elizabeth Short, if you want to surrender, as indicated by the postcard now in our hands, I will meet you at any public location at any time, or at the homicide detail office in the City Hall. Communicate immediately by telephone or by mail.
On January 29th, the police receive another message. It is contained in an envelope addressed in typewriting to Captain Donahoe. It states, I have changed my mind about surrendering. I'm afraid I won't get a fair deal. At 1 p.m., with no further word received from the message sender, another answer is drafted and signed by Captain Donahoe, Deputy Chief W.J. Bradley, and Deputy Chief Thad Brown. It states in part,
to the slayer of Elizabeth Short. It is not within the power of any police officer or any police department to make terms. And the sentence upon conviction lies within the discretion of the courts. However, all police officers are well aware that there are two sides to every story. We can only promise that you will receive fair treatment and a just trial.
No further word is received from the self-identifying killer. Then, shortly afterward, another strange phenomenon occurs in the Black Dahlia case. On February 6, 1947, at Fort Dix, New Jersey, a corporal approaches the desk of his commanding officer and stands at attention.
Well, Corporal, what is it?
I have a confession to make, sir.
Confession?
Yes, sir.
Well, what is it?
You've read something about the Black Dahlia murder case, the one that took place about a month ago in Los Angeles?
Yes, I believe I've read something about it. Why?
Well, sir, I was on leave in Los Angeles at the time, and... Well, sir, I'm the killer of the Black Dahlia.
On February 8th, 2 days later, the corporal signs a 50-page statement, a confession to the murder of Elizabeth Short. In addition, he produces a pair of trousers on which bloodstains are found. The Homicide Bureau makes a very careful study of all his claims. The result?
The corporal's statement is confused and wandering. No details of the murder are included. The facts that have been given have been very carefully checked and the conclusion reached. It's our opinion that the corporal is not suspect in the murder of Elizabeth Short.
In the able hands of Sergeant Ed Barrett, the Central Homicide Division files on the murder of Elizabeth Short continue to grow. Other confessions are received and found false, until a total of 23 persons have claimed to be the killer of the Black Dahlia. a total believed to be unprecedented in American police annals. New clues are examined, new suspects questioned. The investigation continues. And today, 3 years and 8 months after the discovery of the body of Elizabeth Short, the sentiment of the Homicide Division of the Los Angeles Police Department is still expressed in this way.
It is our intention to keep the files open in the death of Elizabeth Short until we've obtained the arrest and conviction of her killer. We consider the investigation to be still very much alive, although at this time the identity of the murderer still remains unknown.
Unknown? No. The killer of Elizabeth Short is not unknown. Somewhere in whatever town or city this person is hiding, someone of you has seen him today, has spoken to him, eaten lunch and dinner with him, knows the location of the spot where he beat and tortured her over 3.5 years ago. No, the cold-blooded killer who took the life of the Black Dahlia is not unknown.
Somebody knows.
Now listen carefully, please. Listen, all of you, wherever you may be. We're going to give you a recapitulation of pertinent facts in the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. Better make a note of them.
And remember, by following the instructions we shall give you in a moment, you may be the one to earn a $5,000 reward.
Now, here are the actual facts in the case. Elizabeth Short, 22 years of age, known as the Black Dahlia, was found dead in a vacant lot in the 3900 block on South Norton Avenue in Los Angeles, California.
The time was approximately 11 o'clock in the morning, Wednesday, January 15th, 1947.
The police believed that she had been held prisoner and tortured by a sadistic pervert for some time before death, possibly for as long as 6 days, since her whereabouts are unknown, from the time that she entered the Biltmore Hotel at 6 o'clock on the evening of January 9th.
Her statement that she was intending to meet her sister there was found to be false.
Now, here is one of the most important facts concerning this case. No trace of the clothing she was wearing at the time she entered the hotel has ever been found. Here's a description of that clothing as contained in a special police bulletin published at the time. Please listen carefully.
She was wearing a black suit, no collar on coat, probably cardigan style. White fluffy blouse, black suede high-heeled shoes, nylon stockings, white gloves, and a full-length beige coat. She carried a black plastic handbag about 8 by 12 inches in size.
Ladies and gentlemen, if any of you possesses information that may have a bearing on the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Short, Black Dahlia, and please don't send guesses or hunches, but only actual, authentic information, follow these instructions so that your name and identity need never be made known unless you wish. Now listen carefully.
Write your information on a plain sheet of paper. Do not sign your name. Instead, sign it with 6 numbers, any arrangement of any 6 numbers. Then tear off a blank corner of that paper with a ragged edge. Write the same 6 numbers on that corner and keep it. Mail the rest of the paper with the information to Somebody Knows, Hollywood, California. You need tell no one what you have done.
Mail your letter to Somebody Knows, Hollywood, California. And if the information you supplied leads to the arrest and conviction of the killer of Elizabeth Short, we'll announce your signature number on your local CBS station. Then, if you don't want your name to be known, go to your lawyer or doctor, your priest, minister, or rabbi, and have him present the torn corner of the paper to any CBS station. In this way, you do not need to appear in person.
If the torn corner matches the original paper containing the information, the $5,000 reward will be yours.
Remember, you out there, you who have murdered in cold blood and think you've gotten away with it, listen, you cannot escape. There is no perfect crime. Remember, you are not unknown.
Somebody knows.
Tonight's case was written by Sidney Marshall from information in the files of the Los Angeles, California Police Department. Research was by Maurice Zim. Music was composed and played by Milton Charles. Somebody Knows is a James L. Safier production in association with CBS by arrangement with the Chicago Sun-Times and is based on a copyright owned by W.L. Finstad. It was narrated and directed by Jack Johnstone. In order to be eligible for the reward, letters containing actual, authentic information leading to the arrest and conviction of the killer or killers of Elizabeth Short must be addressed to Somebody Knows, Hollywood, California, and must be postmarked not later than midnight, September 13, 1950. Arrest of the guilty person or persons must occur within 90 days of that date, and conviction must be within 1 year of tonight's broadcast. If more than one person gives the information leading to conviction, our judges will divide the $5,000 reward among them in proportion to the importance the judges attach to the facts supplied. And in this, the decision of our judges will be final. This is Frank Goss saying good night, and remember,
somebody knows.
There's always an unusual adventure in store for you when Casey, crime photographer, takes his camera in hand to track down the criminal to his lair. Casey, crime photographer, is a regular Thursday night CBS feature. Stay tuned for his latest adventure, which follows immediately on most of these same CBS stations. This is CBS, where you find Arthur Godfrey's daytime program every Monday through Friday, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That's the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Short, also known as the Black Dahlia. August 24th, 1950, on Somebody Knows, starring Harry Bartell.